From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. A group of teens hanging out, joking, singing songs, nothing unusual. But there is a lot of emotional baggage in this room, a painful shared journey.
When we reached the U.S. border, there were some that couldn't keep walking, and they were just left there.
This is a safe place, a gathering spot for teens who've been lonely for a long time.
When I first got here, I didn't know anybody. I didn't trust anyone.
On today's show, the mental health needs of undocumented immigrants.
Our tools of sit in my office and talk about this may have no validity whatsoever.
Also, workplace wellness. Everybody's doing it, but what are the benefits? And is my boss telling me ever so subtly that I look fat in my pantsuit? First, the news. I'm at work right now, believe it or not. I'm wearing my gym outfit and I'm a little bit out of breath and I'm trying my hardest to follow a Zumba instructor. Not doing very well. Up, up, left, left, wrong direction. This is The Pulse. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse will watch paint dry if that's what it takes to understand the latest scientific developments. And sometimes we learn that not all big questions have big answers.
Energy right where you use it. Point of use energy generation.
You're really just a very specialized fish walking on very modified fins.
It's kind of like, how did they do that? How did they have that capability when we don't?
Anesthetics are really good at what they do.
If it gives people pleasure, if someone's making money off of it, it must be bad.
I don't know, it's a mess.
Could this be elevated potassium, but I'm afraid to say
it's actually going to think like a soda.
I'm literally holding in my hands a human heart.
On today's show, will tiny nanomotors revolutionize medical treatments and surgery? And treating mental health issues in an all but hidden population. But first, back to that Zumba class.
Mike in, grab some water, have a towel.
Thank you. That's Zach Seward, Pulse Innovation Reporter. What's going on, Zach?
Well, we're talking about workplace wellness programs, which have sprouted up with a vengeance in the last decade or so. It's everything from work-sponsored biometric screenings to anti-smoking programs to health coaching, and yes, even Zumba classes. It's a wide net, workplace wellness, but as these programs become more and more popular, things are changing.
Where the market's evolved to is not just a phone call or a meeting with a coach. Now where the market's moving is into a technology realm.
Michael Rosenfeld is the president of WellNow, which is a wellness management company in Trevose, PA, just northeast of Philadelphia. When he started his company 8 years ago, Rosenfeld says workplace wellness was a different ballgame.
When we started, the industry was kind of afraid of asking their employees to disclose information, kind of an Orwellian thing. You know, I'm asking you to draw blood. I'm asking you to answer questions about your health. And they felt like that was kind of over the top.
That has changed. The Orwellian uneasiness on the part of employers has been subsumed by the bottom line realities of the rising cost of offering health coverage. Workplace wellness is now a $6 billion industry. Recent data suggests that about half of all companies with at least 50 workers have some sort of wellness program. And if you work at a really big company, it's almost certain that you have access to at least one.
Given where healthcare costs have really risen to, it's I need to get involved because if I don't, my costs are going to pretty much go out of control.
The backdrop for all this is the ongoing crisis state of the American healthcare market. Chronic conditions, many of which are from so-called lifestyle diseases, drive lots of spending. Rosenfeld says the idea behind workplace wellness is to help people understand the intersection of lifestyle and health. If you can give them the tools, classes, or support to make a change, they might feel better, and they might help their employer avoid costly health claims down the road. But the thing is, just how much employers are saving thanks to wellness programs is now being questioned.
We still find evidence for
the programs improving health and health-related behavior, we just don't find that this saves a lot of money.
That's Soren Matke, and his report last summer for the RAND Corporation was a gut check for the workplace wellness industry. RAND, a leading policy analysis firm, was tapped by the government to do the most comprehensive evaluation of workplace wellness programs to date. Going into it, the conventional wisdom was that every dollar a company spent on wellness yielded $3 in return.
Our estimate for the Department of Labor report said at best these programs are cost neutral when it comes to healthcare cost. And actually the Pepsi study that we just published a few weeks ago showed that return on investment was only 25 cents on the dollar for their specific program.
The soda maker has a long-standing and really comprehensive program. Matke stresses that wellness programs do seem to chip away at what the RAND report called a current epidemic of lifestyle-related diseases. Think obesity, diabetes, heart disease. And even if the narrow business case for them may not be so strong, Matke says wellness programs probably aren't going anywhere. Another study last summer from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that most employers still swear by them, with the idea being that something, anything to fight rising health costs might be worth keeping. But RAND says some employers are likely to switch gears going forward, offering more targeted ways of getting bang for their wellness buck. And that's what a handful of new wellness startups are also banking on.
Pick a character.
I'll go with Kevin.
Okay. Glad to hear that. Everyone usually goes for workaholic Wendy.
I'm sitting with John Cooper, the founder and CEO of LifeVest Health, and we're looking at a laptop with an image of the bumbling Kevin character from the sitcom The Office. He's walking me through how it all works.
We have this underlying concept of building a stock exchange for your health and treating your health like a stock that will go up and down as you improve or neglect your health.
It's all based on biometric screenings and tracking measures of your health. If your blood pressure goes down, your stock goes up. You stand to make more money. Say you light up during a lunch break, your stock goes down. You can see it on Kevin's hypothetical dashboard, money as both carrot and stick.
So what does he do? He goes to add his record that week. He, you know, mentions that he's been smoking. He saves in right away. He gets instant feedback. So it says, hey, that cost you $5. You just lost 146 days from your life expectancy.
That's bleak, man.
You know, we like to give people real-time feedback, and that's a real message, right? That's something that people can – it's something that people don't shrug off, really.
LifeVest is new to the market. The Philly-based startup relocated from Denver about a year ago. It recently signed JetBlue to its roster of a dozen or so companies. Cooper says the thing that makes them stand out in a crowded field is money.
There's a powerful association between having – an investment in your health or having skin in the game, taking on a little risk and actually affecting your behavior change.
Direct financial incentives for participating in workplace wellness programs are still quite rare, according to the studies from RAND and Kaiser. But no surprise here, they also found that cash tends to be a good motivator. Cooper says it's early yet, but his company is seeing promising engagement numbers, a partial validation of the startup's approach to workplace wellness that's firmly rooted in behavioral economics.
We use every sort of accountability tool there is out there. So we're using financial incentives. You've got competition with your friends. You've got your family who's holding you accountable. So in that sense, it is gamified, but it's not, you know, a video game for health.
But do we really want employers wielding more effective tools for coaxing us to work out? Cooper says better health is a win-win, and easing concerns around employers having too much access to personal information is a major focus industry-wide.
They can see, you know, what does my Atlanta office look like? But they don't see, you know, what does Bob in accounting look like?
LifeVest thinks it's poised to ride a wave of structural change in the healthcare landscape. The Affordable Care Act allows companies to dangle bigger financial rewards for hitting health goals and impose stiffer penalties, too. For example, the law lets companies make smokers bear up to 50% more in premiums than non-smokers. Soren Matke of RAND says aligning incentives to create better public health is probably a good thing, but thorny ethical issues are likely to emerge.
So I think many people are okay with penalizing smokers if you offer them a way out of the addiction. But if you look at obesity and eating behavior, that's a much more nuanced and complex problem.
With cash incentives, companies like LifeVest could be walking that thin line while getting us to walk more too. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
So let's work through some of those ethical issues Zach just brought up. Here's Art Kaplan, a medical ethicist at NYU.
I don't mind if somebody puts an exercise room at work. I'm not against the workplace being one place in our lives where, you know, health can be promoted. But giving my boss, my employer, the right to sort of boss me around in the name of health, I think is ethically suspect. Why? Well, for one thing, the boss's motive is to save money. It isn't my health, it's to save money. Now, if the boss is going to return some of that money in my salary, that's more interesting. If it's just going to kind of be on the bottom line or go to executive compensation, well, I'd rather have somebody encouraging my health maybe who's not connected to my paycheck. Another problem with corporatized health promotion. Yeah, the company's fine if you want to get down there and get on that treadmill. Of course, they may not make an hour for you during the day to go on the treadmill. It's up to you to be there at 5 a.m. or it's up to you to be there at 9 p.m. Is that a way to keep you around work or is that a way to make you healthy? What if the workplace is stressing you out? Does the boss care? No. It's certain kinds of health things that, you know, they're in their interest, but other things they're not doing anything about.
And some employers are going as far as to penalize people who won't quit smoking, who won't regulate their blood pressure. They make the health insurance way more expensive for them.
Penalizing the worker's bad behavior. You see companies saying, well, if you smoke cigarettes, we're going to charge you a lot more for your health insurance. Now, is anybody charging people more because they own horses and ride them and periodically fall off them, which turns out to be a high-risk behavior? Are they worried about people owning swimming pools where people slip and fall and cause all kinds of injuries? It may not escape the notice when the boss goes skiing. There are orthopedic clinics at the bottom of the ski slopes. They're there for a reason. It's not the world's safest activity. So my point is this. Picking on a vice is not fair. If you're going to penalize bad behavior, then you got to penalize equally risky bad behavior, and people don't do that.
It also seems to be an issue with privacy, with people's privacy.
So I hear some companies saying, yeah, we don't want you smoking at home, or we're interested in what you're doing, you know, in your own time. Well, now that's too far for me. I want health encouraged. And as I said, the workplace is one place you can do it. A school is one place you can do it. But I really don't want work coming into my home and saying, hey, you, get off that sofa and go run around some more. This is my time.
But the company might say, well, Art, we're paying for your health care.
And only in America, where healthcare is linked up to work, would we even have this discussion. We have the boss in the middle. I know they're paying. At the same time, it seems to me a price that we don't want to pay to give your boss the right to tell you what to do on your own time or to put your boss in charge of your health record. Let your doctor do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Art Kaplan is director of medical ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. And here is one more thing to think about when it comes to workplace wellness.
One of the things that we've known for a long time is that we tend to copy other people's behaviors.
That's James Fowler, a social scientist at the University of California, San Diego. He wrote a really popular book called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. And in this context, social networks means your friends, your family, your coworkers. Fowler argues that these networks have a huge impact on our behaviors and healthy and unhealthy habits.
If I sit you next to someone that I randomly assign to eat more, you will eat more and you will not even be aware that you've eaten more. And so we have this really rich literature of peer effects where we know both observationally and experimentally that there's a relationship between what you do and what the people around you do. I think what Nicholas Christakis, my colleague, and I have investigated that's new here is that we've taken that one step further to look not just at the impact of your friends on your behavior, but of your friends' friends. In our research, we're finding that these effects, they go out to 3 degrees of separation.
Fowler and his co-author used the Framingham Heart Study. This is a long-term big data project that looked into factors contributing to heart disease. And they found clusters of unhealthy behaviors among people who traveled in the same social circles.
And the reason why is because you're connected to those people through this set of steps. They may be your friend's friend. And if your friend's friend influences their friend and your friend influences you, then your friend's friend is influencing you even though you didn't come into direct contact. So think about, you might start a diet. And you might be, really excited about it, and you realize this is a good way for me to get control over my health. And you share this information with your friend. And so then your friend does the diet as well and loses weight, and then their friend does the same thing. You can also have situations where people act as carriers. You know, there's a metaphor here of like disease transmission. Your friend might not actually change their behavior, but they learn about your success, and so they relay the information to another person. So you lose weight, and your friend's friend loses weight, even though your friend doesn't lose weight. And so you can get these effects that spread from person to person to person throughout the social network that create these clusters of health.
James Fowler has written Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. So when I went to that Zumba class at work, and I also signed up for our Maintain, Don't Gain weight control program, maybe I inspired a coworker, and maybe I even made you healthier. You're welcome. Coming up on The Pulse, at first glance, it's just a group of teens hanging out. But underneath, there's some serious emotional baggage. Addressing the mental health of undocumented immigrants. Next on The Pulse, here on WHYY. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. About 11 million undocumented immigrants live in the U.S., and their presence has been at the center of a fierce ongoing political debate. But putting politics aside for a moment, this is a population that has often faced a series of traumatic events and is living under very stressful circumstances. Reporter Yowei Shaw looked into the mental health needs of undocumented immigrants and joins us now to talk about a series of reports that she has produced. Hi, Yowei.
Hi, Maiken.
So what kind of mental health needs are we talking about?
The main thing is trauma, and there are multiple levels of trauma when it comes to undocumented immigrants. The first being reasons for why you left your country in the first place. And often it's very harrowing circumstances. There could be persecution, there could be torture. And I met a woman named Zainab at Nationalities Service Center. She had to leave Guinea, which is a country in West Africa, because of the political situation there.
When I got at the airport, I was just crying.
She had been beaten in the middle of the night because of some volunteer work she was doing for a politician. And here she describes her arrival in the U.S.
I lay down on my suitcase, was crying. I remember someone come over to ask me, "Why are you crying? What's wrong?" It was very hard to leave my country, to leave my mom. And my little son he's 2 years old. I will never forget that. I left them.
So Zainab, in addition to dealing with all of the emotional stress of leaving her country under those circumstances, she also had to deal with the stress of being undocumented in the U.S. once her visa expired. So just the hardships of trying to survive in a new country with no friends or family without status.
I was going through a ladder. I left my family. Who will be the one who's going to help me? No one can see in your heart what you're feeling. And you lost. You are really lost.
So, Yowei, are there mental health resources for people like Zainab who have experienced so much stress and might be feeling the effect of it?
There are a few resources out there. Obviously, there are issues with language access and lack of insurance and, you know, the fact that a lot of these folks aren't reaching out to access available services. But one of the main places that is helping this population is La Puerta Abierta, which means the open door. And they're really the only place in Philadelphia that is providing free counseling to undocumented immigrants. But there are limitations. They're completely volunteer-run. They primarily work with Spanish-speaking immigrants, and so they're struggling to keep up with the demand. In addition to that, there are a few other clinics and physicians who do this pro bono work on a small scale.
And I'm wondering also if our concept of mental health treatment works. I have spoken to providers who have said, you know, in a lot of other countries, there is no word for depression. There is no word for trauma. So when you try to talk about that, people look at you and think, what are you talking about?
Yes. So there is a pretty big cultural disconnect that can happen.
Within certain cultures, the idea of expressing how one feels about something may have no validity whatsoever and might actually invoke a lot more terror.
That's Dr. David Goodwin, a psychologist at the Belmont Center for Comprehensive Treatment, and he works with refugees.
And so our tools of come and sit in my office and talk about this and tell me how you're feeling, you can see that there could potentially be a dramatic cultural mismatch.
And so a lot of agencies are trying another approach. So art therapy, community behavioral health programs where there's an art activity usually paired with storytelling exercises. And they found that that's been a natural way to get people to open up about their feelings and also begin to process their trauma. And I actually spoke with a woman named Selma who participated in a Build-A-Bridge International arts group. And she's from Pakistan, and she's never done anything like this before. And she showed me this really big poster that was filled with all these drawings that, people had made about their immigration story.
It was great in a sense that people from different communities, from different faith, coming together and sitting together on one table and expressing themselves. We were linked with one word, that is our pain and grief. But that pain and grief brought us together, and it was good that at the end of the day that it was gone, and we experienced love and happiness. We have survived, fought back, and defied the odds of life.
So, Yowei, it sounds like having this shared experience is a really important factor in healing in this setting. And shared experience also plays a major role in the first report you filed for this series on the mental health of undocumented immigrants. And that report focuses on teens. In the last 2 years, the number of unaccompanied children who cross the border alone and end up in federal custody has nearly quadrupled. So in fiscal year 2013, that number was 25,000. In Philadelphia, there are about 75 of these youth who live in foster care. And Yowei, you spend time at a Philadelphia program that creates a safe space for these young people to come together, to hang out. So let's hear that report.
In a lot of ways, Domingo is your average model teenager. He has good manners. He does well in school, especially math class. And when he's not doing homework, he likes taking naps, going out with friends, and making music under the name DJ Bless. But the story of how Domingo ended up as an 18-year-old sophomore at Benjamin Franklin High School is anything but average. He can explain himself in Spanish.
Y salí en enero, 5 de enero de 2012.
On January 5th, 2012, I left my home in Guatemala. I said goodbye to all my family, to my grandparents. And that was a day that will forever be in my heart.
At first, Domingo didn't want to leave Guatemala, but his grandparents told him that because he didn't have parents, he needed to support himself and go to the U.S. for better opportunities. Domingo's grandma paid a human smuggler to take him to the U.S. with a group of others. The trip in total took about a month and a half. At one point, it got so cold outside that Domingo couldn't feel his knees.
En frontera de Estados Unidos llegué y entramos en desiertos.
When we reached the U.S. border, there was only desert. Sometimes we only ate once a day. We only brought water and junk food. There were some that couldn't keep walking. Some got cramps and they couldn't continue. And they were just left there.
Domingo made it all the way to Arizona before running into immigration officers and entering federal custody as an unaccompanied minor, children who cross the border without parents or papers. Unaccompanied minors are typically from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and many are placed in foster care, shelters, and group homes around the U.S. as part of a program run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. That's how Domingo ended up in West Philadelphia, living with two other unaccompanied minors and their foster mom, who didn't speak Spanish.
Porque cuando llegué aquí, casi no conozco a nadie.
When I first got here, I didn't know anybody, and I didn't trust anyone. And because of that, I couldn't express what I truly felt.
Enter the youth mentorship group El Sueño al Futuro, that's Spanish for dream for the future. Domingo became a member after a caseworker referred him to La Puerta Abierta, or The Open Door, an all-volunteer project of the nonprofit Intercultural Coalition for Family Wellness. La Puerta Abierta runs the youth group and also provides free counseling to undocumented, mostly Spanish-speaking immigrants in Philadelphia. Every week, 6 to 8 undocumented teenagers get together to hang out, talk about their feelings, and sometimes even sing.
Sometimes we do write nice things. Sometimes we share stories so we can smile. But then there are other times when we share difficult stories, and then we cry.
La Puerta Abierta director and longtime family therapist Kathy Tillman says the group is a place for young people to meet others struggling with similar issues, things like leaving family behind, cultural adaptation, and childhood trauma from their countries of origin.
It's everything from intense family turmoil, a lot of abandonment, unfortunately a lot of sexual trauma, physical trauma, kids being married off when they're very young or put to work for other families and taken out of school at a very young age.
Group members are also just dealing with the regular problems of being a teenager, documented or undocumented.
We all know that adolescence is that kind of goofy time when, you know, there tends to be higher levels of impulsivity and, you know, trying to find your way in the world.
But without U.S. citizenship, the consequences of making a mistake are much higher for undocumented teenagers who could be deported.
Whether it's getting your girlfriend pregnant or going out drinking and getting arrested and being in big trouble because you're not here with legal status yet.
While unaccompanied minors like Domingo tend to get immigration status eventually, others in the youth group have a much more uncertain future.
When Kathy asked me to help her start to create the youth group, I was like, because I had so many stuff to do.
Take Damara Tejas, who crossed the border from Mexico with her family at age 8. Tejas is undocumented, and when Tillman approached her about the youth group, she was at a low point in her life.
Well, at that point, I was stressing about college because I'm a legal immigrant from Mexico, so I thought I couldn't go to college, and many people said we couldn't go to college.
She thought the only way was to get a scholarship or to pay expensive out-of-country tuition herself. To save up money, she worked almost 40 hours a week on top of going to high school and getting good grades.
It was very hard. I had my Mondays off, and that was my fun day. And I sat home, read, and don't speak to no one because that was like my day to keep calm and stay home and just relax.
Tejas can finally relax a bit more. She's a freshman in college now and has been able to pay in-state tuition. But she still doesn't have work authorization or a driver's license, though that could change once she hears back about her application for deferred action for childhood arrivals. Through all this, Tejas says an important source of relief has been getting to blow off steam at La Puerta Abierta's youth mentorship group. It's even given her an opportunity to help other young people.
Well, some of them were
They were shy when they started going to the youth group, but they started to open up more and talking about their experiences. And it's really hard for some of them because they're here without anybody. But we try to help them and stay with them. And now we feel like we're a really big family.
Domingo is perhaps the best example of such transformation in this family. Everyone I talk to says he used to be the shy kid in the room. But when I saw him at youth group, he was the class clown, making all the jokes.
With a cheesesteak.
A cheesesteak or a cheesesteak?
Cheesesteak.
That's buen cheesesteak con queso, which apparently is the South Philly version of buen chiste, or that's really funny in Spanish, with cheese on top. For The Pulse, I'm Yowei Shaw.
Cheesesteak.
This report is part of a multimedia mental health journalism series made possible by the Scattergood Foundation. Next week, we'll hear Yowei Shaw's report on a group that accompanies undocumented immigrants facing deportation. For more on that, go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. A new study on mammograms caused quite a stir this week. The new research from Canada concluded that mammography does not reduce the number of women who die from breast cancer. We reported on the fierce debate over the value of routine mammograms a few weeks ago, and this, of course, has added fuel to the fire. Radiologist Emily Conant leads breast imaging at Penn Medicine.
So, yeah, it really is. Here we go again. You know, all of this debate is about how one looks at the data and what data one looks at. And this controversy will continue because we do know that mammography is far from perfect.
The study used the gold standard approach to research. It tracked the health of 90,000 women for a quarter century. That's given some policy watchers confidence in the results. But Conant says others have questions about the quality of breast images in the study. Other reputable studies have found that routine mammograms do save lives. Go to whyy.org/thepulse to check out our review of the latest research and for a discussion on overdiagnosis and mammography. Coming up on The Pulse, let's turn on the bedroom lighting because we're going to chat with a sexologist who helps women have more satisfying sex lives.
It's their responsibility to create a sexually satisfying session.
That sounds like work, but seriously, it's fun. That's coming up on The Pulse here on WHYY.
I've been waiting for a guy to come and take me by the hand. Your these sensations make me feel the pleasures of a normal man.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott.
Je t'aime. Je t'aime. Oui, je t'aime.
Do you see the red hearts everywhere? Buckets of roses, boxes of chocolates. It's Valentine's Day weekend, a reminder that perhaps it's time to spice up the old love life. Philly-based clinical sexologist Susanna Mayer spends her days helping women have better sex. But before we get into all that, I really wanted to know, what exactly does a sexologist do?
Well, a clinical sexologist works with clients, helping them with their specific goals, and they do it from an educational approach and giving specific suggestions. They do not do therapy. That's what a sex therapist does.
Goals. What kinds of goals are we talking about?
Oh, it varies. I mean, sometimes the goal is just to have a good orgasm. Sometimes a goal may be to have sex. They haven't had sex for a long time. The goals vary tremendously.
How do you go about helping them achieve that goal? Let's say the goal is to have
more sex.
I created the personal pleasure pattern because if women are not following that pattern, they come in saying, I've got a low libido based on following somebody else's pattern. But if they find out their own pattern, what works for them specifically, they realize, in fact, they don't have a low libido. It was just sort of hidden, in a sense.
So what is that personal pattern, and how do you find out what it is?
Ah, yeah, that's a good one. Well, first we have to clear away shame. I found that out when I was working with focus groups for women, and I suggested they read erotica. I suggested they maybe even look at some very sexual explicit videos. And the first thing they said to me was, we're feminists. We can't do that. And I went, excuse me, but I'm a feminist also, and I get really turned on watching those things.
So once you get beyond whatever shame you may be feeling, then what do?
I find out why women are not enjoying or having sex. And sometimes it's because they feel that their lover doesn't have very good technique. They're lacking in technique. So we talk about that. And what I really try to get women to understand is it's their responsibility to create a sexually satisfying session, in a sense, or time. I hate calling it a session, but, you know, when you're in bed and you're romping around and having fun. But in the end, if you're not satisfied, you have to take responsibility for that. You have to grab the vibrator if that's what's going to work for you. You have to use your hand, or you have to instruct your partner to do what you would like. But you're the one that's ultimately responsible for your pleasure. And I show women how to have orgasms. It may sound odd, but nobody really teaches that. First of all, most women are too embarrassed to ask their doctors, and a lot of doctors would be too embarrassed or wouldn't even know how to describe how to do that.
So as a sexologist, what's your hope? What is kind of your wish for people's sex lives?
To view sex as fun. You know, take all the drama, all the negative, all the shame, everything else around it. And, you know, I usually tell people, I mean, this is how I usually leave my clients, is make your bed a sandbox and have fun in it. And if you're not having fun, then you may want to do something about that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Susanna Mayer is a sexologist in Philadelphia. She also hosts monthly salons where people read erotica. Do I have your attention? Go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Okay, and now let's please return to non-blush territory where I feel decidedly more comfortable. Scientists at Pennsylvania State University are the first to create tiny motors or nanomotors that fit inside a living human cell. This breakthrough in basic science is an advancement on a long road towards someday deploying microscopic robots inside the human body to hunt down and treat illness. Tanya English has this story.
To really understand what these new nanomotors are like, completely throw out the notion that a motor is a loud, hulking thing. Instead, think of the stripped-down, basic definition. A motor is simply any machine that supplies power to propel something else. Chemistry professor Tom Malouk has created motors that are elegant, slim, and very, very small.
So they're the same size as a bacterium.
Nanomotors are not new. Scientists have been tinkering and improving them for nearly a decade.
You can make these things go really fast. You can make them spin around. They're like a bunch of bumper cars running around aimlessly.
Earlier motors were gassed up using certain fuels which are toxic to humans. Since then, researchers have figured out how to use ultrasound to power microscopic gold metal rods. Once you crank up the power, the sound waves bounce off the metal rods, which then ram and prod cells along.
Think of it as a sound wave going this way, smack, and then another one, smack that way. So it's boom, boom, boom.
So this is what's new. Malouk and his team have learned how to slip their motors inside living cells under a microscope.
So now the gold rods don't just usher cells along. These new nanomotors ricochet around inside, crashing into subcellular structures.
One of the things that we observe and we don't understand yet is if we tickle the cell someplace, it giggles somewhere else.
It's kind of like that little hammer that the doctor uses to test your reflexes. Nanomotors could be a new tool to let scientists poke around inside a cell and see what happens. Lots of people working in the field of nanoparticles say they're inspired by the 1960s sci-fi film Fantastic Voyage. In the movie, a medical crew and their submarine are shrunk down to the size of a red blood cell and then launched inside a patient's body.
Four men and a beautiful girl, off on a fantastic voyage, exploring an unknown universe, unknown dangers.
Tomaluk says even with all its camp and bad special effects, the movie is a pretty good way to imagine what nanomotors might accomplish someday. For example, one of Maluk's good friends is a brain surgeon.
I would like to make his life easier. I would like to, instead of having the patient with his, you know, cranium sawed open, it would be really nice if the patient could just sit in a comfortable chair. And instead of having a scalpel and everything, we just inject into his arm through a syringe, say 100 million of our nanomotors.
Maluk says instead of standing in a surgery suite, the doctor would sit at a video game console and send out future generation nanobots to deliver medicine or maybe puncture cancer cells.
So that would be the dream. What we'd like to do is work on the pieces of that dream.
And that's what's next. While Penn State refines its nanomotors, powered by ultrasound, other scientists are working on propulsion or thinking about ways to make sure all this new technology is truly compatible with the body and safe.
You know, you don't want anyone promising quick cures for cancer or anything like that. It's fundamental research.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Do you want to see those nanomotors at work? We got a video at whyy.org/thepulse. And if all of this sounds so incredibly futuristic, think about this. The first computer, ENIAC, developed right here in Philadelphia, is just only turning 68. Now, that's the occasion we should really celebrate on February 14th. The first computer was about the size of a gymnasium and designed for the sole purpose of calculating artillery firing tables for the United States Army. So, where do you think nanomotors will be in 68 years? And now it's time for Patient Files, your stories of illness, recovery, and healing. Philadelphia-based choreographer and dancer Brian Sanders is internationally known for his boundary-pushing work. His pieces have included dancers suspended from the ceiling on spinning unicycles, bouncing across the stage on pogo sticks, and diving headfirst into garbage cans. After struggling with debilitating hip pain for years, Sanders, who is 47, just had hip replacement surgery 7 months ago.
And then I'm sliding in, and I'm looking around.
It doesn't feel good.
As a choreographer, I really try and push my limits as far as creativity of the human body, what it can do. Not just in dance, but I'm going to say in space, in this universe. Playing with gravity, playing with friction and momentum and every kind of physicality you can imagine. I really try and delve into the joys of movement inside of the human body. The onset of my discomfort in my hip was so slow and progressive. By the time I realized it was unbearable, about 3 years it took to really feel like it was something beyond just an injury and that I should go get it checked out. I'm sure I put my body through a little extra rigor inside of what I do as a dance artist. But I also think that I'm genetically disposed. Both of my brothers and my mother's side of the family all suffers from bad knee and foot arthritis. In my left hip, I had total hip replacement. So they go in and they remount the pelvic joint and saw off the femur and hammer in a new head to the femur. Maybe I do this in life a lot, but I was quite in denial about the severity of the procedure and what it was going to do, and I thought I was just taking the car into the shop for a quick fixer-upper, a tune-up. I was quite in shock when I got out of the hospital and saw the size of my leg and how much it had swollen, and realized that they sawed my leg off and, you know, put in new parts. I knew that at some point in my life I was going to need to transfer from doing to pointing my finger and having others do. I didn't think I was giving up a future. I thought, if anything, I was in enough pain that I would be creating a new future.
First you try and flick it off. Flick it off. First up, up.
And the people that I had talked to who had been through hip replacements and that kind of thing, you know, encouraged me that the other side of it was considerably better than where I was. And I'm happy to say here now that it's absolutely the case. I have great imagination as to what the human body can do. In my mind, I can fly, I can float, I can feel joy inside out. And that's what I try to put into the human body. I did ask a question to my physical therapist as to whether or not she thought I could hang upside down safely from my leg. I was hanging from my foot upside down in the air. So I was nervous about trying it on the replaced hip. She suggested I didn't try it. It's absolutely true that my physicality is a small part of my choreography, and that most of my choreography comes from my imagination and my mind. So my new task now is to translate that onto new bodies. I'm back to life as normal, which you know, is tying my shoes and getting down the street without pain. The other splendid part of my life where I jump and fly around is a little bit coming back, but I don't need quite all of it to be happy. I'm really just happy to be a normal person.
Nice, Connor.
Philadelphia choreographer and dancer Brian Sanders. He was interviewed by Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro. And we have photos of Sanders and his team rehearsing those intricate moves. Go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can find out about something cool happening next week. We're going to be at the Sixers game on Tuesday, February 18th. So you can meet the Pulse crew and we can talk about citizen science projects. So hopefully we'll see you there. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Jeanette Woods produced segments for today's show. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, the assistant producer, Mac Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, the chief content officer. One more thing, a quick nod to our friends at Philly Love Notes. They are doing their annual Philly Twitter Love Fest. So why do we love Philly? One word, brains. Lots of them. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.